Hey everybody, welcome back to the MLB.com Fantasy 411. Today is Friday, July 26th. Don't adjust the tone or the levels on your audio listening device. This is Corey Schwartz. I'm hosting today because Mike Ciano is out somewhere, probably on the 12th hole or so by now. That would be our guest. We'll be joined in a little while by special guest Derek Van Riper of RotoWire. But now to my right, my able co-host for today is longtime 411 guest and contributor, Joe Sheehan. How are you doing today?
I like the way that you pronounce my name, Sheehan, in honor of Mike Ciano.
Yeah, I know how to pronounce it properly, but it's just what came out.
No worries. Good to be here. Good to be back in the studio. Good to be back doing the 411, man.
Back in the saddle. All right, so I'll do a little bit of the hosty thing, and you do like the analyst thing, and we'll just sort of bounce that stuff back and forth.
You just want to be JB.
I don't have the voice or the looks or the talent. So let's start out with the big news of kind of going just headlines from the week rather than just what happened yesterday. Obviously, the big story in baseball right now, Ryan Braun suspended for the rest of the season. We don't really need to talk about, you know, who did what, when it happened, negotiations. Obviously, this is from a fantasy baseball standpoint. A guy who is arguably the number one pick on draft day now goes out for the season after playing 61 games and becomes a huge, huge question mark going into next year.
I think that you've got to take away the issue of biogenesis from what Ryan Braun was going to be at 30, 31, I should say. Yeah. Anyway, because a lot of guys who are power speed guys stop running when they get to this age. So I think independent of biogenesis, we might have been sliding Braun down the rankings just because he's to the age now where he might be a 4-category guy instead of a 5-category guy. And beyond that, that Brewers lineup, a little bit devoid of OBP, a little bit devoid of power behind him, the context numbers weren't going to be that great. So even if you take the suspension out of it, because remember, he started 2014 with a clean slate, this is all behind him, maybe Braun was already going to be somebody we're going to be dropping a little bit.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned the speed. You know, one of the points we bring up a lot is that speed is elective. You know, stealing is elective. Obviously, there are fast guys and slow guys, but they make a decision about whether or not to run. Braun, only 4 steals in 61 games, was caught 5 times, so he wasn't running a lot anyway. 298, 9 homers, 38 RBIs, decent numbers. So let's prorate that out. Let's say, had he continued doing everything he was doing, 325 homers, 95 RBIs, 15 steals, or 12 steals.
With the thumb problem.
Right, with the thumb problem. Those aren't terrible numbers, and with his track record, you still figure him as a first-round guy, but I don't think you can say he's a consensus top 2, top 3 pick next year like he was this year.
No, I think that if you're keeping him in a keeper league, obviously, you're drafting him, but this is where I disagree. I'm not even sure he's a late first-round pick.
Really?
I look at the back end of the first round. That's where you start taking your more 4-category power-only guys. You're talking about your Vados, your fielders, the guys you don't really
Robinson,
expect to
Cano,
win. Right. Cano is another good example with the positional value. Put him up against Carlos Gonzalez now, and where I think Braun would always have been listed ahead of Cargo going, you know, previously, especially with Cargo's history of not hitting on the road. You look at what Gonzalez has done this year. You look at the fact that Braun might not run as much. You look at the age difference. I think Gonzalez is one of those guys that moves ahead of Braun. I think that those first basemen are guys that move ahead of Braun at this point. I look at, if I'm, and again, this is, it's July, and you're asking me to put together, you know, I'm going to be sitting at a draft table in 9 months. A lot of things are going to change. But I think Braun right now is an early second round draft pick, and you could convince me that he's even lower than that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we didn't mention Andrew McCutchen. Obviously, Mike Trout and Miguel Cabrera are
slam dunks.
Well,
we're way ahead of
them. Yeah, so I mean, that's just off the top of our heads. We've got 8 guys.
Yep.
So now he becomes, let's say, a wheel pick at the bottom of the first round. He kind of reminds me of Troy Tulowitzki from a fantasy value standpoint. Tulo this year was the guy that if you had the 5th or 6th pick, you weren't going there. Too much risk. But if you were down near the wheel at the end of the first round and you could pair him up with a much more reliable player, that might be where you went for it. And I could see him going sort of around that turn this year.
And it goes into I think there's a real difference here between auctions and drafts as well. Talk about this a lot. You can't win your draft in the first round, but you can lose it.
Yes.
And do you want to take the guy who could implode as opposed to taking somebody a little more reliable? So let's say you think that, you know, Ryan Braun is actually probably going to be $2 to $3 better than Cano, just to use that terminology. But Cano's reliability probably puts him ahead of Braun.
Yeah, and that's a Ron Chandler theory that when you talk about the first round, you're focused more than anything on return investment.
Exactly.
You know, it doesn't matter if you get 90 cents on the dollar or 95 cents on the dollar or $1.25 on the dollar. You don't want to get 30 cents on the dollar, and that's what Braun paid this year, unfortunately.
Do you see significant downside risk here at all? Do you think that what do you think is the baseline, the 10% Pacoda, if you will?
Well, I mean, it's tough to say because, you know, one of the things about PEDs, and again, not to get into who's right and who's wrong, but we have no way of knowing, all right, if the guy used, what he was using, how long he was using it, and we have no measurable way of what the effect was. You know, you take a guy like Melky Cabrera, you know, busted for PEDs, coming off two huge years and having a terrible year this year. Well, you could say, look, those were age 26, 27 peak seasons fueled by a high BABIP that might have happened anyway. You know, is it correlation or causation? So with Braun, you're going to say, all right, maybe he cleaned up this year because of the, you know, the appealed test last year, and that's why he was struggling. But you could also say age 29 season, late peak, the thumb problem, mm-hmm. the diminished lineup, just like you said, all these other factors, it might have happened anyway. So there's really no way we can look at the correlation, but there's no way to determine the true cause of these things.
Yeah, for me, the whether or not he was using PEDs is not going to factor in my slotting him for next year. The studies that have been done, the large sample size studies have indicated that the effect of PEDs on performance statistics is negligible. And if you want to get into individual examples, we could do this all day.
Yeah, right.
So I think knowing it's a non-factor for me.
I think I'm going to start trying to get out of the habit of using the term PEDs.
Sports drugs.
And call it banned substances.
We'll go with that too.
Because we don't know that they're enhancing performance. I mean, that's the biggest thing that came out of the Mitchell report. A lot of guys who use PEDs stunk,
yeah.
Right? All right, let's move on from that. Obviously, a lot more guys are waiting to hear when they get their day in court, but we'll wait and see on those. Obviously, the other big news going on right now is the trade deadline. We've got a couple of those to talk about, but let's talk about closers because you can't do a 411 without closer follies. You want to do the music? Very good. All right, first one, Jason Grilli goes on the DL with a sore elbow forearm area. We're still gathering details on that, but it looks like he'll be out for a while. Mark Melanson will fill in. How does this affect the fantasy landscape?
I was watching that game the other night when Grilli left the game, and we can call it a sore forearm elbow, but it looked bad.
Yeah.
And what percentage of time does a guy go on the DL for a sore forearm elbow and not end up with a scalpel involved?
So right, absolutely.
I think we got to sort out who's going to be the closer. Now, what's interesting is that the next game, Justin Wilson actually started the ninth. And then Melanson closed. This is the game in Pittsburgh.
Where, right, but it was, DC,
it was a non-save situation.
Right.
But I wonder if, I mean, Melanson's closed before, but this might be an opportunity for Clint Hurdle to match up here. I mean, there are going to be situations where three lefties in the ninth, you might want to go with Justin Wilson instead. So I think it'll be, I don't know necessarily that it's going to be one guy.
What do you call it, a 70-30?
Well, just based on, maybe even more than that. But I do think that Wilson, let's put it this way, if you can't get Melanson and you're in a tight saves race, I wouldn't mind picking up Wilson.
Yeah, so you bid a big number on Melanson, you hedge with Wilson and hope you maybe sneak a couple
of things. You think Melanson's not owned in most leagues? He had, what, a 0.?
Well, the funny thing is, in my NFBC league, 15-team mixed seven-man bench, he got cut last week.
Wow.
So this is the first week that he's on waivers. So the guy who had him is absolutely kicking himself.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, the guy who's leading the league in saves, naturally because he had Grilli who had 30 saves, has the most free agent money. So I'm just sort of assuming he's going to spend the nut to get Melanson, but then he'll drop behind me in fab money and I'll get the next big name closer to drop.
Not a bad player. The one thing I'd say here is that I think that Grilli is done. I could be wrong about this, but I don't think we're going to see Grilli the rest of the year, which means if you're thinking about bidding on Melanson or Wilson, you can do it knowing that.
Might as well go heavy.
Exactly. I'm thinking back to Tout earlier this year when I bid $12 on Hector Ambriz because he had two saves, and I think those are his last two save opportunities.
Right.
You're not going to see that here. I think that Melanson and Wilson are going to combine for pretty much every Pirate save the rest of the way.
Yeah, and you know, just a couple more points about this. You wrote a great newsletter talking about the short shelf life of short relievers, how they kind of, you know, their stars emerge quickly, shine brightly, and then fizzle out. Melanson pitched pretty well for Boston last year after coming over from Houston. This year, 40-6 strikeout to walk rate and 48 1/3 innings. So one of the things we've been doing a lot the last year or two is applying the Jason Gray test. What's different about this player? Melanson, a lot more cutters, a lot fewer curveballs and fastballs. He's found that one pitch that's really effective for him and riding it. So yeah, there's something different about this guy. A different player having a great year, spend the money, right?
I like the fact that we don't have to rely anymore on what the guy says or what the pitching coach says. We can actually track that.
Yeah.
I love the fact that we can actually go in and say, this is what this guy is doing differently.
Well, when it gets tougher, and we'll get to some of these other guys, I don't want to jump around in this rundown too much, which is a Mike Ciano thing to do. Some guys, you look at the repertoire, the velocity is the same, the repertoire is the same, but the results aren't the same, and you have to dig deeper. All right, let's talk a little bit more about closers, and then we will morph into the trade deadline. The Brewers deal K-Rod to the Orioles. Jim Henderson will take over in Milwaukee with John Axford setting up. Those guys were probably rostered everywhere. The real question now, I think, is what happens in Baltimore, because K-Rod having a great resurgent year and Jim Johnson struggling after last year's huge season.
K-Rod is having a good resurgent year. I would not describe it as great. I think that
okay.
Because it's better than his recent seasons, it kind of gives him that impression, oh my God, it's K-Rod. But, you know, really, he hasn't been a superstar closer in about 8 years now. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's any risk to Jim Johnson. I think that if Johnson was going to lose his job, he would have lost it by now.
Well, here's the
Darren
thing.
Darren O'Day's been effective in that bullpen. I think that there were options for Showalter to make a move.
Yeah, and Showalter, I think, traditionally has been pretty patient with his closers, yes. If I recall. K-Rod was 10 out of 10 save opportunities in Milwaukee. Johnson blew 3 saves all of last year, has 6 already this year. But again, talking about what's different about the guy, everything about him is the same this year. Strikeouts are a little bit down, but the batting average on balls in play, home run to fly ball rate have gone way up. Last year, maybe he pitched in some good luck. This year, maybe in some bad luck.
Sequencing. I mean, sequencing has a lot to do with it, and pitchers generally, especially pitchers who pitch from the stretch all the time, like most of the relievers do, you can't even say that it's a pitching from the windup, pitching from the stretch thing that you might say with starters. So, no, I think I think this bolsters that bullpen. Remember, they don't get a lot of innings from that rotation. It's really a 6-inning rotation, so they used a lot of bullpen innings last year. They've used a lot of bullpen innings this year. Getting Rodriguez helps them from a baseball standpoint. I don't think it has any impact on us as fantasy
goes players. Into that Brian Mattis, Tommy Hunter sort of 7th, 8th inning crew. All right, so if K-Rod's available in your league, maybe throw a buck out there.
Let me make a point here about Henderson and Axford.
Sure.
Axford's been out of his mind, basically, since that bad start.
Yeah.
Henderson will close. Axford's setting up. I don't think that holds. I think Axford's going to probably has 10 saves in him the rest of the way.
Well, I've said a lot of times throughout the course of the year when their bullpen was kind of muddled that, you know, Axford, you know, again, looking at his stuff was always there. He was striking people out. He had velocity. His problem is purely command, and that was, you know, he's a guy that mechanics are really important. You know, we talk about mechanics a lot, and it's kind of a nebulous thing, and, you know, no one really knows what it means who's not in the industry. But in a conversation with Rick Peterson while doing an event at Bloomberg Sports a couple of years ago, and that's a double name drop for you, he was talking about how Axford, his drive line towards the plate is very erratic, that when he's stepping towards the plate, so he's able to get on top of his pitches, he's got great downward movement and great command. But when he tends to step more towards third base and start to throw across his body, that's when things get haywire. So maybe they fixed that mechanical problem early on, but by then things had become entrenched.
It's a moment like this where you really miss having the TV show.
Why is that? Because I'm gesturing?
That whole thing would have been a lot better with video.
Right. So imagine, folks, that I'm gesturing with my right hand and my arm is driving down.
Well, no,
but
more
now
mean,
I'm
we could
leaning
have had
this
actual
way,
video of John
so it's more of a sidearm thing. All right. That would be cool.
But the worse your mechanics, the easier it is to get off them. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the way to, and Axford's never, you know, been Greg Maddux with that. So no, I think the velocity's there. I think that Axford's a better pitcher simply than Jim Henderson. I think he's got to get some saves before the year's out.
All right, cool. Another guy who got traded, the first, I think probably the first big domino to fall was Matt Garza, said to be the top starter on the trade market. That's up to a matter of opinion. First start with the Rangers, gives up 2 hits to the Yankees, and then goes on to give up only 1 unearned run and 7 1/3. Now 7-1 with a 2.87 ERA overall. That's great, but how's it going to affect him going to Texas?
You would expect. We saw the disaster side of this last year when they traded for Ryan Dempster. And you could see in Dempster's numbers the seeds of his potential demise, and Dempster wasn't very good for the Rangers down the stretch. Garza's simply a better pitcher than Dempster is. And he's had success in the American League already, and I still think there's enough of a difference between the leagues that matters. So whereas Dempster fell apart, he wasn't somebody I bid on at all last year, I'm putting everything I have. I'm not going to get him because I don't have enough, but I have whatever it is, $46 fab. I'm going to go after Garza because I think Garza has the stuff, the command, and in that with that team, he's going to get the bullpen and the offensive support. That's what the offense has been an issue for them, but their bullpen's amazing. So I think Garza's good for 6 wins the rest of the way, good ERA, good whip. It, maybe not 2.87, but still very good numbers.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, a lot of people have been viewing the Cubs as, you know, sort of a, you know, a patsy this year because overall they're not very good, but offensively they've been a pretty solid team. He was getting decent run support. The bullpen cost him a couple of wins, but not lately. You know, remember Marmol blowing one against the Mets in Citi Field where, who was it, Kirk Nieuwenhuis hit the walk-off homer. But for the most part, he's gone deep into games, so the bullpen hasn't had a big issue. And the Cubs are a decent defensive team. You know, Texas, as you alluded to, hasn't been a great offense this year. They stand the risk of losing their top home run and RBI guy, Nelson Cruz, in the Biogenesis thing. Plus, he's obviously got to go in the AL now, pitch in that great hitter's park and face DHs. So I wouldn't instinctively or just sort of reflexively say that, oh, going from the lousy Cubs to the terrific Rangers is great news for him. I think there is some risk factor introduced as a result of this trade.
Literally, the somewhat worse hitter's park and the better hitter's park. And yeah, maybe the run support is not going to improve the way you might expect. But honestly, I think the bullpen makes up for that, the extra wins. Yep. I think the fact that he's just a better pitcher. I mean, this guy's a very good pitcher. I mean, he's been hurt the last 2 years. And I'm going to say maybe he's not, you know, an 800 winning percentage and a 2.87 ERA guy.
Did but you if you look at his career, win percentage?
I'm just, from a fantasy standpoint.
Okay. wow.
But if you look, it's actually funny. If you look at his BR, his ERA has been between 3 and 4 in every full season of his career, which you...
And usually right around 3.6, 3.7, a very
that level of consistency is highly unusual. So no, I think that it's when they made the trade from a baseball standpoint, I'm like, you know, Garza, Harrison, Holland. There's actually not a whole lot of difference among those three guys. Mm-hmm. They're all basically number two starters on good teams that are indistinguishable from each other.
Okay, the Cubs also making another deal. As we are taping this podcast, it's been reported that the Alfonso Soriano deal is now official, although I haven't seen a release from the Cubs as we're recording this, but as of the moment, Soriano's believed to be on his way to the Yankees for a pitching prospect. You're banging your head on the desk, but let's be fair. The Yankees are 28th in baseball in OPS against lefties this year. They had to do something, didn't they?
A guy with a 310 OBP against lefties.
They're not acquiring him for the OBP, right?
Yeah, so he runs into 8 home runs the rest of the year. I'm sorry, I can't... It's like you're doubling down on the Vernon Wells. Okay, what's the worst contract we could possibly acquire? Okay, what's the second worst contract we could possibly... I'm sorry, I know this is the fantasy show. I can't get past the baseball aspect. If your season is spiraling so badly that you see Alfonso Soriano as a solution, just sell.
Wow.
Sorry, I'm...
All right, so purely from a fantasy standpoint now, you're an AL-only leaguer. Soriano's out there.
Unfortunately,
he's going
to
play.
Yeah.
Right, he's going to play. He's cheap power. You know, see, he's one of those guys we laugh at for all of his limitations as a player, but as a fantasy player, always in the low to mid-20s in homers. Last year ran into 30. Always in the 80s in RBIs. He's running a little bit more this year already in double digits and steals. You know, he's a guy that everybody loves to hate, but from a fantasy standpoint, he gives you some numbers.
I don't even hate him. I just...
Pick on him. Love to pick on him.
It's not even about Soriano. It's about the Yankees and their unbelievably weird season. No, who do you think Soriano for? 8 to 10 homers the rest of the way. 260 batting average. I mean, the thing about it is he doesn't get any benefit from moving to that park. Soriano hits everything to the left of center field.
Yeah.
So it's not like he's going to pop, you know, do the Ichiro thing and pop 5 homers.
He's one of the most, again, this is some Sport Vision research that we saw back in the spring. Soriano is one of the most extreme pull hitters in baseball. I mean, obviously, you can look at spray charts and metrics, but Graham Goldbeck from Sport Vision put out a metric measuring where guys hit the ball relative to the edge of the plate. Mm-hmm. Soriano hits the ball out in front of home plate to a greater degree than any other hitter in baseball. He is cheating to pull the ball and try and hit a home run more than any other hitter in baseball.
Older fly ball hitters. That's what they
He's in the right park for that.
Which is also the reason I think he might just collapse.
Yeah. Well, it hasn't happened yet.
I think that there's a decent chance he hits 175 with a 235 OBP. This year.
Wow, interesting. All right, fantasy baseball is a zero-sum game. Soriano's out. That's good news for Junior Lake. He will play every day for the Cubs the rest of the way. I know you're not Kevin Goldstein or Jason Parks or any of those guys, although you do have your merits over them. What do you know about Junior Lake?
That he's not really this good. I think it's interesting. Everything I know about Junior Lake is that he's been an infielder his whole career. He's been playing the outfield for the Cubs. I actually like this idea. If they're going to turn him into some super utility guy, a player who's really probably not good enough to be a regular, and God knows he swings at everything. I like using him this way. If they want to turn him into Daryl Thomas or Juan Beniquez or other players who haven't existed in baseball in 35 years, I think that's a really good use of resources. Tony Phillips would be the most recent example, exactly. So, he's going to get the bat to the ball, but he's going to, let me take that back, he's going to swing the bat, but he's not always going to get the bat to the ball.
You know, it's interesting, and looking at his minor league stats today, 271 career hitter in the minors, almost exactly a 4-to-1 strikeout to walk rate, and prorating the counting numbers, 10 to 12 homers, 25 to 30 steals a year. Everything about this screams a cheap version of Starling Marte to me. You know?
Starling Marte is better for physical schools.
Better from
physical tools.
Uh-huh.
And
performance-wise, they've been very similar.
Yeah, I think of Lake as somebody who's going to be a utility guy. Not, I mean, Marte is somebody who could be an average plus outfielder, left fielder. I don't think Lake is that guy.
Okay, there you go. He will play a lot, though. Remember, playing time is king. All right, two other minor league prospects called up this week. A little bit of a surprise, I think, in the timing and the fact that they were both brought up together. But ultimately, we're expecting to see them, and now they're here. Christian Yelich and Jake Mariznick for the Marlins. They will take over as the left field and center fielders for the club for the rest of the way. These are two big-time prospects, so I assume you like them a little bit better than Lake?
Don't want them together. I think the fact that they've been called up together is a little bit misleading. Christian Yelich is one of the best prospects in baseball, left-handed hitter, good power, struggles with lefties, but you know, he just hasn't seen all that many of them. Jake Marisnyk was one of the guys they got in the Jays trade, and he's less of a prospect. He's kind of more of a fourth outfielder with some tools. Yelich is somebody who might be a middle-of-the-order bat. Marisnyk isn't going to be that type of hitter. Yelich is going to play center field. I believe they've been playing Marisnyk on the corner. So big difference in terms of these two guys, not just in terms of the short term, but more really more in terms of the long term.
Yeah, it was, you know, again, looking at their minor league numbers, I mean, I'm, you know, familiar with the scouting reports in a basic sense. Very similar. You know, both have, let's say, 15 to 20 homer power right now based on the minor league numbers. Good stolen base potential. Marisnyk, 95 steals in 377 mm-hmm. minor league games. That's a good number. But Marisnyk has a lot more swing and miss, so he's probably a lot more than of a batting average risk than Yelich, who was a 313 hitter in the minor league. So they're similar in some respects, but different. They both, from a fantasy standpoint, again, purely 5x5 fantasy, they both do have their various appeals.
Marisnyk's going to be very good at getting from first to second. It's getting from home to first that he's going to struggle.
Okay. But hey, in fantasy, you know, steals a steal.
Are we going to talk about anybody who isn't a low OBP guy here?
Yes. Justin Verlander.
That's the
worst segue. That's a Seattle-style segue. All right, let's go from Christian Yelich to Justin Verlander. You saw that one coming, right? Verlander gets hammered by the White Sox.
I saw this piece of paper.
Yeah, okay, exactly. Verlander gets hammered by the White Sox on Thursday, allows 7 runs on 11 hits in 6 innings. I looked this up. His ERA is now 3.99. That's the highest it's been since his first start of the 2011 season when he gave up 3 runs on 6 innings. What's going on here?
It was funny, a couple starts, it was about a month ago now, he went on the radio and he said he found a mechanical flaw. And his next 3 starts, he had 2 7-inning shutouts and then he had a game against the White Sox where he's had 7 good innings and then blew up in the 8th. But if you looked underneath, the runs weren't there, but the strikeout rate wasn't there, the strikeout-to-walk ratio wasn't there. I think we're just seeing an older pitcher who's worked a lot, he's not old, but he's got a ton of innings on his arm, kind of moving down from that MVP Cy Young-type peak to being something else. Now, I don't think he's 3.99 bad. I think Verlander, most of his career, was a 3-3, 3-4 type of guy who gave you a lot of innings. I think that's the guy he's going to be going forward.
And he had that great peak, and I think that
exactly.
may be skewed. You know, it's interesting.
We do this a lot. We expect a guy to keep playing at his peak level, and this is what happens more often than not.
Yeah, you know, Verlander, it's interesting. You mentioned the strikeout rate down. His strikeout and walk rates, on a percentage standpoint, are their worst since 08. This year, he's also giving up a much higher batting average on balls in play than usual, 330, well above his career mark. So you factor in more base runners with the walks, more balls in play with fewer strikeouts, and then bad luck on batting average on balls in play, and you get these blow-ups happening.
Going to stop you right there. Just say it's not bad luck. It's the worst defense in baseball history.
Right.
It's one of the worst defenses.
It's bad luck for him that he pitches in front of that defense.
For a good team. Yeah. To have this bad a defense over a period of years is highly unusual. I talk about it a lot with Rick Porcello as a personal favorite.
Yeah, right.
If he ever gets out of there, you're going to see just how good he is. When you talk about that 330 batting average on balls in play, this is why I don't think Justin Verlander is as bad as he's looked. I think a lot of it is a skill decline from an all-time peak. Mm-hmm. That two-year stretch is very, very strong. But this is that Tigers defense that just can eat the wrong eat guys.
You know, and one other note to make about him as I stammer and stutter through my point, again, the Jason Gray test, his fastball velocity this year, you remember Jason Gray?
Used to
play fantasy, won a couple
aluminum siding guy?
Something like that. What?
From fantasy land.
Oh, okay. Verlander's average fastball this year is down almost 3 miles an hour since 2009. And velocity isn't everything, but changes in velocity are important.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at his pitch-by-pitch, start-by-start this year, he can still dial it up when he wants to, but on average, his velocity is just down, and that's something he's going to have to adjust to.
He's thrown 20-some-odd thousand pitches over the last 6-7 years.
That can't feel good.
I'm saying, I don't think this is an unusual story. Again, we get this idea that, oh, well, he's special, he's different, he can do this. Everybody's arm only has so many pitches in it. So, yeah, just forget the rest of this year. Where is Verlander going forward? Is he that top tier, or now you do put him in that next tier down? Garza versus Verlander, 2014.
I'd still take Verlander.
Okay.
Because I think Verlander, even in a bad year this year, by his standards, is comparable to Garza in a good year. This is the best Garza's ever pitched over his career, but it's only 12 starts. You know, you've got to expect some regression from him and some positive regression from Verlander, as you said.
But there are very few pitchers who are as consistent at their level as Matt Garza is.
That's true. But he's easier to peg. Doesn't mean he's as good.
Right.
All right, now speaking of a guy, this is a guy who I thought was very consistent, not at the same level. Yovani Gallardo, again, gets hammered on Thursday. 6 runs on 8 hits against the Padres. His ERA is up from 4.09 to 4.88 over the last 6 starts, and I wonder if this is the same as Garza. Fastball down, strikeouts down, batting average on balls in play up, and things explode.
Same as Verlander?
Same as, isn't that what I said?
Garza. I just want to make sure we're talking
about the same as Verlander. Yeah. Same issues, but writ large.
And this is a guy who's actually talked about as maybe one of the top tier trade candidates. And right now, it's hard to trade for a guy who's giving up fly balls like that. And he's always been a fly ball guy. And now, if when you lose velocity as a fly ball guy, it can get very ugly in a hurry. I'm not sure if you trade for him. Some of this is probably the defense in Milwaukee, which is also a team that's never put a good defense on the field. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that he's somebody I can target. In a 12-team, if I have a 12-team league right now, I have to seriously consider putting him on my bench.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, not to skip ahead a little bit, he's got 2 starts next week. We're going to have to give some serious thought about whether or not he's a guy you can trust in a 2-start week against good offenses.
Right.
He was my number one starting pitcher that I drafted this year in Tout Wars Mixed.
Where?
For $15. Okay. He went for 15. I was like, I think it's a decent price. I'm okay with that. Less than 90 seconds later, Jordan Zimmermann went for 13,
ooh,
and I about punched myself in the face.
Why didn't you have them both?
Because I only budget for one, okay, quote-unquote, you know, double-digit starting pitcher. For the same price, I would have taken Zimmermann, and I could have saved a couple of bucks on the deal. I was kicking myself. But that's the thing about an auction, unlike a draft, you can't control sequence.
Right.
You know? There are pros and cons to both ways, and that's where it hurt. But
most people usually keep a list of future available pitchers and go, hey, that other guy's.
But I had Gallardo was like a $17 pitcher.
The strikeouts usually make him that valuable.
Right, exactly. You know, I figured, look, mid-3 ERA, 127, 128 whip, something like that, and 200 strikeouts, 15, 16 wins. That's kind of how I pieced it together.
Where is this team?
What's that?
Where is this team rated right now?
Not good. We'll talk about that with Derek Van Riper.
Do you have the best Tout Wars team of the fantasy baseball pair? Fantasy 4-1 pair.
I have the best Tout Wars team in... I have the best mixed Tout Wars team in Bizarro Tout. Let's put it that way. All right, let's move on.
You and Seattle have a real good year.
Tough year. All right, one more pitching note. Tim Hudson suffers a gruesome fractured ankle. He is out for the season. Very unfortunate thing for him. The story here from Atlanta is that they were looking for starting pitching to begin with. Alex Wood made a spot start. I like him, but maybe not for this year. Brandon Beachy will probably rejoin the rotation on Monday. I think that's really the big fantasy angle. What's your view on him?
I can't. There's no way to say this without sounding like a jerk, so can we just put a pin on the whole human factors, Tim Hudson, horrible injury, long-term veteran, just from a baseball standpoint?
That's
a career-ender,
right?
I'm not even talking about it. Just from the Atlanta Braves standpoint, I don't know that this makes them any worse. If you're replacing Hudson with Beachy, I don't think that makes you worse.
Interesting. What are your expectations for Beachy, though? I mean, you know, basically you're making a comp to Hudson. He was not sharp in rehab, walked 20 guys in 40 innings. That's not like him.
I watched him almost outpitch Steven Strasburg in June last year at a game in D.C., and velocity's there, location's there. If the innings are going to be a little bit short, that's the one thing I might say he's not going to be able to do is work deep in games. But he's somebody I expect to come up, have, again, you can't do wins just because that Braves bullpen is what it used to be. The offense has been questionable. But if you tell me he has like a 1.15, 1.2 whip and an ERA of about 3.1, 3.2.
Really?
Yeah, I think he's going to be that good.
I think you're a little bit.
And I would say probably a 21, 22% strikeout rate.
I think you're a little over-optimistic. Just the fact that he was so erratic on rehab and had to stay longer and had some setbacks a little bit. The command wasn't great. I'm not as bullish on him as you are. I certainly think he's worth picking up even in 12-team mixed leagues, but I would tone down my expectations just a little bit.
Dead serious question, and I don't have an answer for it. Do we know what the correlation is between rehab performance and return performance?
No, I haven't seen any research on that. I would say it's probably not indicative of, let's put it this way, it's not, you know, it's correlation versus causation, but it certainly gives you a cause for concern. If a guy's struggling with his command against A-ball and AA and AAA hitters, what's he going to do in the major leagues? So,
well, the reason you send him out on a rehab
is to regain the command, but there's 20 walks and 40 innings.
Without looking at it, and again, this, I'm not somebody who does this a lot, but I'm going to say completely off the top of my head, I think there's probably very little relationship between how a pitcher pitches on his rehab and how he does, particularly in his first 4 or 5 starts back in the major leagues. If you want to tell me that the guy's velocity, if you tell me a guy who normally throws 93 is throwing 89, that I'll take seriously. But tell me he had 4 walks in 6 innings, I throw out my hands.
All right, very good. So you think it's basically spring training?
Yeah.
Okay, good. That'll be a good future research topic. All right, one more note
for
before
somebody
we...
else.
You're not the research guy?
Ooh.
Well, one more quick note before we go on to some quick hits and then welcome in Derek Van Riper. George Brett resigned or promoted himself out of the Royals hitting coach job, went back to the front office. I just wanted to bring up Eric Hosmer homered twice on Wednesday, his last day of George Brett as hitting coach. 48 games with George Brett as hitting coach, 309, 10 homers, 880 OPS. The other 49 games this season, including yesterday, his first game with not George Brett as hitting coach, 261, one homer, 651 OPS. All right, is this just fun with selective end dates in your opinion?
We don't know yet. Let's put it this way. I mean, Justin Smoke, I think, has probably similar numbers. Like, if you look at Justin Smoke for the first 2 months of the season and then Justin Smoke since, you're almost certainly going to get something that looks like that. So, I don't know yet.
That was a good visual,
We do know that the whole team didn't hit any better with Brett as hitting coach. But, you know, the important thing for the Royals is that Hosmer and Moustakas, you know, kind of improved. Moustakas also improved, not as dramatically, but Moustakas hit better under Brett. So.
All right, so where is the true Eric Hosmer? I mean, you know, 309, 10 homers in a third of a season, 261 and a third.
This is the problem. It's like, I think Eric Hosmer might have turned a corner. I just don't know necessarily if I'm ready to say it was George Brett.
Sure.
It may have happened for any thousand.
Well, I read some stuff early on. You know, again, we
started pulling the ball a lot.
You know, right, exactly. You know, one of the things that Brett was saying was start trying to drive the ball. That, you know, when I watched Hosmer, I had a Hosmer and Tout Wars last year, and I watched him play a lot, and it looked like he had gotten very defensive. Like, he was focused on fighting off pitches and trying to serve him out. You know who also went through that? Chase Headley.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that last year, there were a lot of stories about this, that Headley said, I'm going to try to hit more home runs. I'm going to find pitches that I can try and pull and drive. And I think that's what Hosmer was trying to do. Now, again, do I think he'll hit 300 with 30 homer power the rest of the way? Maybe not. But if there is a change in the guy's approach, that's real. You know?
No, I'm buying in on Hosmer. I have him in every format in which I can possibly actually have him. I believe that the line
Vinyl,
with Brett.
CD and A-track?
A-track, yeah.
It took me a second to get there, but I got it.
I don't think he's going to decline from those stats this point forward.
Okay, very good. All right, a couple of quick hits, and we will move through these very quickly. Derek Van Riper, I assume, is on hold by now. Miguel Cabrera, who's been out with the sore hip, he is hopefully going to be back in the lineup on Friday, according to Jim Leland. Dominic Brown of the Phillies goes on the 7-day DL with a concussion. Keep an eye on that one. Carlos Gonzalez came out of the game early on Thursday with a sprained right middle finger. He is day-to-day. Miguel Montero had tests on his sore back. Everything came back normal, so he is day-to-day.
Is that Trevor Bauer's fault, too?
Ian Desmond, day-to-day with a blister on his hand. We're all day-to-day, aren't we, Joe? Lance Berkman, having problems with that knee, talking retirement again, so you can reclaim your draft money on him, as I did in Tout Wars. And finally, Brandon Morrow, stop me if you've heard this one before, likely out for the season with a nerve issue in his right forearm. So another season of disappointment. What am I trying to say here?
Brandon Morrow
broken
is disappointing.
Promises. He disappointed you again this year, yes. So any of those you want to touch on, other than saying Brandon Morrow's disappointing?
Ian Desmond's a pretty important guy for the Nationals. I mean, their offense has just been such a disaster. He's not an OBP guy, but he's in good power at a shortstop. Remember, the other half of that promising second base duo is currently down in AAA. So everything's gone wrong with the Nationals this year.
All right, there you go. All right, now we are very pleased to welcome in our special guest from rotowire.com. Derek Van Riper. Derek, are you on the phone?
I'm here.
Terrific. How long did we have you on hold?
Oh, about 30 seconds.
Perfect.
Because I froze.
Excellent timing. All right, thanks for calling in. We appreciate it. Joe and I are here. And, you know, as we always like to do with our special guests, we don't want to talk about fantasy right away. We want to talk about you. We want everybody to get to know you, the real Derek Van Riper. And it's my understanding you are, there's now Mrs. Van Riper in the recent news.
Yeah, she's been hanging around for a little while. We've actually been married, it was 4 years as of this April. And the thing that's fortunate for me, I think, is as someone in this industry, is she's actually been around as long as I've worked for RotoWire, even as an intern, going back to 2005. So she's used to the madness. And you know, people probably come on all the time and talk about how many hours of baseball they watch. And at RotoWire, we obviously cover other sports as well. So it's definitely year-round for me as far as being all in completely. But yeah, she's been with me since the beginning of this whole trip into the industry.
Wow.
Does she like sports? Does she play fantasy?
Yeah, you know what? I think it worked out in my favor, actually. She comes from a family. They have season tickets for the Packers. They love all sports. So the previous guy, I guess, in the picture was a Trekkie, and he didn't fit into the family at all. And for me, you know, being just kind of insane about fantasy sports, going back to college kind of worked against me. I was in a class once. I had to take a marketing class as part of my comm arts degree. And I was sitting in lecture one day working on a spreadsheet for a baseball league, trying to pinpoint some dollar values. And this girl leans over and she just says, hey, what class is that for? And I didn't have a good answer right away, so I kind of just said, well, this is for my fantasy baseball league. And she just immediately just kind of moved back away and had no interest in me whatsoever. But fortunately, yeah, there's at least one girl crazy enough out there to put up with my shenanigans.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When I had a previous job, this was back in the days where you had to do your stats off the Monday and Tuesday USA Todays, and I'd sit there. I was the statistician for my league, and I would key in the stats while I was sitting at work. And it came time for job reviews, and my boss wrote in, Corey should spend a little bit less time working on his fantasy team at work. And I was like, you know, the blood drained out of me. I was like, this is it. He's like, no, I'm not actually handing in this review, but you really need to spend less time on your fantasy team at work. So between class or work, I guess we're kind of doomed. What did you do before RotoWire? You said you were an intern. Have you purely been a fantasy baseball guy your whole life? I mean, who does that?
Yeah, it's pretty rare, and someone was asking about this. I did a draft with some of our customers for football a few days ago, and they said, well, how do I become an industry guy? How do I become an expert? And I said, well, you have to major in fantasy football or fantasy baseball in college. But, I mean, the truth is, for me, yeah, I right out of college, I started interning here my senior year as a student at the University of Wisconsin. Previous to that, I'd worked at Sam's Club for 5 years, just doing a pretty meaningless job, you know, just answering phones, driving forklifts, stocking freezers, just doing basic stuff, and just playing a lot of fantasy in my spare time. So it was very much right place, right time. You know, Peter Schenke decided to move the company to Madison while I was in school, and I can't even imagine any other company like this being anywhere close to Madison, Wisconsin, really. I mean, you had to go to a big city, either New York, Chicago, L.A. typically to find a job like this full-time, but right place, right time, and a great group of guys at RotoWire that I'm lucky enough to work with.
Yeah, the serendipity is a big part of it. Wait, oh, the biggest company in fantasy sports just happened to move down the block. I'm going to get a job there. Well done. Well done, Derek.
Yeah, very, very much serendipitous, no doubt.
Yeah, we had Eric Mack on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he said, no, I always wanted to do this. I majored in communications at Syracuse. I wrote for the school newspaper. He's like, I never wanted to do anything else in my whole life. And I'm like, most people who work in the fantasy industry kind of fell into it. You know, they were an accountant or they were a marketing guy or whatever, and they started moonlighting, and one thing sort of led to another. You're like a purebred almost.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, and I could just as easily be writing for a local newspaper covering high school sports. You know, I could be a Wisconsin State Journal beat reporter just as easily as I am a RotoWire baseball editor. But fortunately for me, I'd much rather be in this position than doing the newspaper gig, just given where that industry's headed, of course, but also from the pure enjoyment standpoint. You know, high school sports are interesting to an extent, but doing that for 8 or 10 years, I think, would have gotten pretty boring.
You say just as easily. I think you need to take a closer look at newspaper jobs these days. You're definitely in the growth industry.
Right, yes. That break definitely went the right way.
But yeah, this is Corey and I sitting here looking at each other, and there's a difference now generationally, where these jobs didn't exist when Corey and I were kind of coming up through the ranks and figuring out what we wanted to do. And younger guys actually, like Eric Mack, like yourself, were able to say, I want to do this for my career. That's where you look at, you know, the guys who've done this, Matthew Berry, Ron Chandler, Corey Schwartz, have kind of made it the career. And this is becoming a full-fledged industry now. This isn't something where you've got to, like, go to your wife's parents or your girlfriend's parents, or your girlfriend's going to take you home and say, what does he do?
You can
say he writes online. He writes, you know, he's a job as an analyst.
He lives in your guest room until he gets a real job. That's what you answer, right?
Exactly. And the great thing about the industry, too, is, I mean, guys like you guys are great mentors. You take people under your wing. You let new guys actually have a place in the business. And I think that's something that I know I'm very grateful for. And I know a lot of the other young writers out there are definitely very, very blessed to have, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, well, it's very generous of you to say we're good mentors. That's usually said about me, not in a positive way.
Well, Derek,
yeah, I've hung out with you at the winter meetings. You're a good mentor.
Yeah, I mean, had a good time at winter meetings.
To a certain extent now, Derek, you're actually in that role because, I mean, you have people coming in through the Madison office all the time, correctly, and you got younger guys looking up to you and say, God, Derek Van Riper, I want to be you. What are you doing? How do you, I mean, you talked a little bit, you know, people are asking you how to get into this industry. What do you do with these, you know, fresh-faced 18- and 19-year-olds who are looking to you like you're a hero?
It's weird to be in that spot. I mean, I'm still 28, so I don't feel that much older. But at the same time, I have to be professional on a day-to-day basis with the 18- and 19-year-olds coming in and looking up to me, as you said. But I like to create opportunities for them, whether it's, you know, writing a column for the site, coming on the XM show, or doing a podcast or things like that, because whether, you know, it's us that eventually gives them a full-time job or one of you guys or a different site out there, ultimately that's what I want to do, is just help other people launch careers into this business.
And that's awesome. You know, it's funny that, you know, when I go to winter meetings or whatever, I meet with job seekers and people early in their careers or whatever, I try and be nice to everybody. And everybody says, you know, oh, it's so great you do this. And I say, look, one of you guys might be my boss one day. I got to be nice to everybody. I can't take any chances, you know?
We had people coming through prospectus all those years, and now they're populating front offices everywhere. And I just look at it as a, my eventual sinecure is I'm going to be able to go tap James Click on the shoulder one day and say, I need a job, dude.
Yeah, right. We hope. One last thing I want to ask you. Early in the season, the first time Joe was on the show, then we had Jeff Erickson on the show a couple of weeks later, and we got Jeff to tell some Joe Sheehan stories.
Why?
Because it was funny. All right, so now we kind of pay it forward, but pay it backwards. You got any good Jeff Erickson stories for us, or at least one you can say on a family-oriented podcast?
All Jeff Erickson stories are family-friendly stories. That I know.
They really are. I mean, Jeff is like the ultimate good guy, and he's the mayor of every place you go. Like, if you know Jeff, you're going to meet everybody else in the room, and generally, because everyone likes Jeff, you have a pretty good chance, unless you're a complete a-hole, people are going to like you, too. But with Jeff, I think the thing he always does every year, and it just amazes me, at First Pitch Arizona, he's always one of the speakers. He's always on one of the Factor Food panels. And there's handouts at this presentation. And I've seen him every year since 2009, and I've gone on this trip. He will play poker until 2 or 3 in the morning, which is fantastic. He loves poker, and it's one of probably his favorite trips all year. And his handout's not done until like 5 or 6 a.m. the morning of the presentation. But he always gets it done, and it always looks good. It blows my mind that he's able to function a little or no sleep every year on that trip and managed to get all this work done while still having a great time.
It's fun playing poker with Jeff and watching him beat up Joe Sheehan and watch Joe get redder and redder and more and more on tilt. That's one of my, we played, so it was you, me, Erickson, Chris Liss.
Oh, is this the thing here?
And Derek Carty. We played at Eric Kesselman's house a couple of times. Eric has won bracelets on the World Series of Poker, whatever, fantastic player. So the first time we played, I'm clearly the worst player at the table. I don't need to get too far into that. But, you know, I got a good run. I got some good cards. I won some hands. And I was taking some hands off Joe. And Joe's playing tight, and he's evaluating things, and he's, you know, analyzing.
Kesselman was doing that.
No, you were doing it to me.
Do you remember how many stops we made along the way that evening?
Yeah.
That was like our third stop. And let's just say that the first two were at establishments that sold certain things.
Oh, here it comes. So I'm winning money and you're losing, and it's because
I was drunk.
But I wasn't. Okay. Kesselman didn't say anything till afterwards. Joe is analyzing each hand. He's like, why'd you raise when I flop the 10-8-7 or whatever? I'm like, because I'm having fun. It was so fun watching you get mad.
And that's one of the things I enjoy. I watch the poker games now. Initially on that trip, I was playing in them, but it's grown to the point where there are so many good players there. It went from being a lesson, and guys will tell you what you do wrong at that table. I've certainly been in your shoes there, Corey, to the point where I just enjoy the interactions of being in the room with them now, because they're great players. Like, half the guys that play in that game could probably go try to play professionally and hold their own.
Those games have gotten a lot harder over the years. Todd, the AFL games.
Todd Zola walks in, puts $20 on the table, and says, "I'm just going to watch."
He went down to the bar and drank. The games have developed a reputation over the years at the AFL to the point where, I mean, you got Paul Sporer of Baseball Prospectus, a very good poker player, and some of these other guys. So we have a lot of fun at those. But yeah, Jeff's ability to take everybody's money until about 4 in the morning, get an hour's sleep, and then bang out a highly valuable 2 pages of information is a little bit terrifying.
This is no good. No good. No dirt on Jeff.
Right. There's no dirt. There's nothing you can say about it.
Clean. You know, I think you just learn how to survive in law school too, on the no sleep plan. And for a guy that doesn't have kids too, I'd expect him to sleep like crazy on a trip like that. But he's a beast. And you know, a couple of years ago too, he got into some purple drink at one of the parties. Not traditional purple drink, but what he was calling purple drink at Jeff Erickson.
I remember that was 2 years ago.
What
I remember
was he drinking?
That. He and Jason Gray were having a good old time, man. I don't know.
I don't even remember that. Wow.
All right, anyway, let's...
Maybe I was into it, too.
you were into the barbecue. All right, let's move on. Derek, we're going to talk about some two-star pitchers for next week. For those who are in weekly leagues, these are some guys they may be considering. Tell us if you want to start the guy or think maybe you would sit him out. First one is Yovani Gallardo at the Cubs and then home versus Washington.
I'm inclined to probably go ahead and take that if it's like a 15-team mixer, you know, like an NFBC-style format or Tout Wars, but it's mostly because of the road trip to Chicago, especially at Miller Park. I just don't like Gallardo this year at all. He's getting hammered in a lot of his home starts, extreme fly baller, and he's just a shell of the guy he was a couple of seasons ago. I don't know if it's the off-field stuff, if it's the UI that's really kind of just kind of crippled him all season. But the fastball effectiveness has been down for 2 years. That's a big part of it. The breaking stuff hasn't been as crisp either.
Yeah, we agree with you. I think Joe and I both agree with you. We talked about Gallardo earlier in the show, and, you know, against low-tier offenses, you might take a shot, but the Cubs are actually a top-10 offense over the last month or so. The Nationals have bounced back since they got Harper, so I think I would sit him on the bench. All right, let's move on. Ricky Nolasco, he will be home against the Yankees, and then another guy going into Chicago to face the Cubs.
I think you got to go ahead and roll with Nolasco there. He's one of those guys that is a little bit better than people give him credit for, and I know we've compared him on our XM show to Zach Greinke, I think during a guest segment with Joe, actually. And probably a case where, you know, the Dodgers are going to score enough runs for him in New York, especially, where even if that turns into a high-scoring game, win probability is pretty high, and you got to like to start at Chicago, of course, just as you do for Gallardo, if you have to use Gallardo.
Yeah, agreed. And, you know, Nolasco, the strikeouts have bounced back a little bit this year. A little bit better luck on the hit and strand rates. Dodgers giving him run support, as you said. I would pitch on that one. Next up, Ian Kennedy. He's got two road starts in Tampa Bay and in Boston.
Yeah, I think that at Boston one really scares me enough to where I'm probably sitting him down. Look at what happened to him in his last home start against the Cubs. The first three innings looked pretty good, and it all just fell apart from there. Fastball command hasn't really been there consistently. I'm sitting Kennedy in just about all formats right now.
And not just the two-star. I think Kennedy is droppable in a lot of formats. I mean, I'm not even sure in NL only he's not hurting you more than he's helping you at this point.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, I have Kennedy in NFBC, and I'm just trying to use him in real favorable matchups, but it's getting harder and harder. I look through his game log. He hasn't had a quality start against what you would call a good offense since opening day against the Cardinals.
I believe it.
And, you know, we talked earlier in the show, not to go off on a huge tangent, about what's different about the player. Kennedy's stuff is the same. He's throwing, his pitch repertoire is the same. He has not had the command this year. Just has not had command. He's been behind in the count a lot. And he's not the kind of guy who can afford to come in at 2-1 and 3-1 and try and blow guys away with a fastball.
Yeah, because he's had some issues out of the stretch as well. So that's been a big part of the issue. If he's like getting runners on base and he's not effective out of the stretch, it's only going to get worse.
Yeah, all right. So we're going to bench him in Tampa Bay and in Boston. Next up, Felix Dubron to the Red Sox, a pair of home starts against Seattle and Arizona.
I think you go for it here because, I mean, Seattle's offense I actually do like a little bit better outside of Safeco, as most people do. But Dubron, better skills than a lot of people want to give him credit for. I kind of like this opportunity for two starts at home this week for him. I think it works out pretty well.
Yeah, agreed. Dubron has allowed three or fewer runs in 13 straight starts, 10 of those quality starts. So he's on a good run. I will start him. Next up, Jeremy Hefner of the Mets, one road start in Miami, then home against Kansas City.
I gloated about having him in a really deep league. I think it's the big show league you're in with me, Corey, but right. It's one of those situations where as soon as I did that, it blew up in a big way. Skills are good, not great. And the thing that stands out to me is actually City Field last year played more hitter-friendly than pitcher-friendly, which a lot of people haven't noticed. But love to start at Miami. I think Kansas City is weak enough. You go ahead and roll the dice on him, knowing that, you know, strikeout rate is going to be mediocre. There's some risk there, but I think you take a chance on it.
I'm with you on that one. Again, one little factoid. In his last two starts against Philadelphia and Atlanta, he gave up a total of 13 runs. He gave up 13 runs in his previous 9 starts combined. So that's a talk about two extremes, but I like the matchup, so I'll pitch too. Finally, last one, Bud Norris, who's said to be trade bait right now, but if he's still with Houston, he will be in Baltimore and then in Minnesota.
At Baltimore, that scares me enough where the prospect of getting a nice start in Minnesota, I'm actually sitting him down as a two-start guy, unless it's obviously like an AL-only league or a very deep mixer, but in most cases, he's a sit for me. That, or the Orioles lineup in particular can just do so much damage at Camden. And Norris can be homer-prone at times, too. That's just a bad fit for him.
With with the Phillies playing well, Cliff Lee's not on the market. With Gallardo pitching poorly, he's not terribly attractive. Now, Jake Peavy might be on the market, but the starting pitcher market is so thin right now that I think Norris almost has to be traded. So I'm looking at Baltimore, at Minnesota, and thinking he's not going to make at least one of those starts. I don't think he's going to be a two-star pitcher next week.
Okay, and one other note, and I agree with what you guys have said. His road ERA continues to be terrible. This year, exactly 3 runs higher than at home. So if he's on the road, I bench him almost reflexively.
That doesn't make sense, given it's a pretty good hitter's park in Houston.
Yeah, it is, but Major League Baseball, on average, the average starting pitcher has an ERA at home about a half run lower than on the road. You know, just whatever the factors may be, home cooking or whatever. But he's just an extreme home road guy right now, sort of like Wandy Rodriguez was in the early part of his career. So I would sit him out. So Gallardo, Kennedy, and Norris, we are going to sit them. Nolasco, Dubron, and Hefner, we are going to pitch them. The exact opposite of what you would have thought on draft day. All right, let's move on. Let's take some fan questions now. Derek, we will direct these at you, so fire away with your answers. This one comes at us on Twitter from The Real KG 513. Would you trade Yasiel Puig for either Bumgarner or Minor in a keeper league?
I don't think I would. I mean, I think I could see Puig being a top 40, maybe even like a top 20, top 25 guy next year. And I think that he has the tools to do it. The Dodgers lineup is pretty strong. They'll probably even add another piece or two between now and next year. And, you know, if you're trying to kind of predict what ADP is going to look like, there's just more value with Puig over Bumgarner or Minor. I guess the follow-up question I'd have for you guys is Minor closed the gap on Bumgarner to the point where they're nearly equal in value?
That's the thing about the question that got me. Bumgarner and Minor are not the same. I like Mike Minor, but Madison Bumgarner is excellent. And I think that if I'm trading Puig for Bumgarner, yes. If I'm trading Puig for Minor, no. I don't trust Yasiel Puig. I don't think the skills necessarily match the tools at this point. I know that there's a lot of people that are very excited about him. There's also one other problem that we're not talking about much. The Dodgers already have three expensive outfielders that are probably not going to be tradable. It's when everybody's healthy, I'm not sure Puig, there's a spot for Puig without creating all kinds of problems for the Dodgers.
They've got to eat the contract on Ethier. I mean, they have to. You know, he's effectively a platoon player on skills.
Yep.
It's a sunk cost. They're paying him one way or the other. Do you want to pay a guy to play and block who right now looks to be a better player, or just put your best team on the field?
You and I know that. I'm saying until they do that, Yasiel Puig's playing time is in danger.
Right. I agree with you also. I think Minor has closed the gap on Bumgarner because we're not just talking about a good season now. We're talking about almost 40 straight starts of high-quality work going back to last year. But Bumgarner has done the full end-to-end 30-plus starts in a season. And this year, phenomenal year, ERA below one, WHIP below one. I can see arguments both ways. If I had to pick one of the three, I would probably take Bumgarner, but I'm more a hitting first guy in general, so I might lean towards Puig. I can see it either way. All right, that helped nobody. This one comes from Jim.
It did, because they heard my opinion, which is the correct one.
Right, exactly. This one comes from Jim Calliu, C-A-L-L-I-U.
Which I keep reading as Jim Callis, our friend from Baseball America.
It's funny, having a daughter, I read it as Jim Calliu, the annoying cartoon character. Eduardo Nunez or Yunel Escobar the rest of the way?
You know, this is the point in the year where you're definitely looking at the standings and seeing which categories you can make up the most ground. And if a few stolen bases can close the gap on, you know, three or four standings points, you go with Nunez. You're looking for just a solid guy with a little more playing time and someone who's going to pile up more RBIs and run scored the rest of the way. I think Escobar is the choice here.
I'm just glad to see there are people out there playing in AL East-only leagues.
Yeah, Nunez has started to hit a little bit lately, by his standards at least, stealing a couple of bags, so I'd go with him as well. This one comes from the Authentic Max. Who to start, Yelich or Ibanez?
I'm taking Yelich in a vacuum, if only because Ibanez, to me, just given his age and how unlikely what he has done so far is, he could easily just fall off the map over the final 2 months. And if the Mariners are out of contention, of course, maybe he's a candidate to be traded to a more limited role. Still not going to play against lefties that much. I mean, there's a lot of downside to what he could do over the final 2 months. Yelich, to me, might be one of those young players who comes up right away and has enough success. He's going to bat second in the order ahead of Giancarlo Stanton, too. So he could score a lot of runs, hit for a decent average. Maybe not provide a lot of power initially, but could exceed expectations.
Yeah, in a vacuum, we'd all be dead, Derek. So just at that point. But I'm with you. I think the collapse potential for Ibanez puts this far and away in Yelich's corner.
Yeah, there's a Steve Martin joke to be made here about getting inside a vacuum cleaner. But you'll retain the shape of the vacuum cleaner. Anyway, this one comes from B. Coghell, B-C-A-U-G-H-E-L-L. On a scale of 1 to 10, I assume 10 being
Irish
good.
Irish names you have trouble with?
It's names. It's reading. On a scale of 1 to 10, please rate this trade. I send Cano and McCann. I receive Patrick Corbin, Carlos Santana, Brandon Phillips, and Jed Lowrie.
I never like giving up the best player in a trade, but in this particular case, I actually believe in Corbin to the extent where, as long as that's a significant upgrade to the rotation, I'm willing to make it. So I'd rate the trade like a 4 or 5. I think it's pretty average, pretty fair for both sides. I could see Carlos Santana putting things back together in the second half, much like he did a year ago. I think the gap between Cano and Phillips this year isn't as wide as it would typically be because the run environment around, the lineup around Cano just isn't as good as it's been in years past. So I think that gives me enough, given the fact that I like Corbin quite a bit here.
To answer the question, 37. I love Robinson Cano, and I love Brian McCann, and I would make this trade in a heartbeat.
Wait, no, he gave up Cano and McCann.
Yeah.
And you like it that much?
Yeah.
See, I don't know. I'm not as thrilled about it because the thing that's left out here is the two players you're benching to make room for Corbin and Lowrie. Now, presumably because of starting pitching, you're probably just cutting your worst starter.
Right.
But again, you know, the point being made about Cano and Phillips, you know, Phillips doesn't run anymore. That was a big part of his fantasy value. He's not a stolen base threat anymore. McCann is having a better year than Santana, flat out. And, you know, who would you rather have the rest of the way? Santana. But the deeper we get into the season, the more current performance matters. And, you know, Corbin, as much as I like him, and I think that slider is a legitimate wipeout pitch, I'm always hesitant about trading for a starting pitcher, period, much less a guy who's 20 starts into his first full season as a valuable asset. So I totally agree. I totally understand your arguments for the deal, but I'm not as favorable towards it because you know what you're going to get from Cano and McCann. There are too many question marks on the other side, so I give it more like a 3.75.
See, and I don't. Between McCann's injury issues and the fact that the Braves seem to love Evan Gattis, I wonder, you know, the playing time is going to be there. I think Santana's better than McCann the rest of the way. Cano and Phillips are a wash just because of the RBIs.
So you just get the other two guys.
And I get the other two guys.
All right. So you give it a 37. Derek's a 5. I'm a 3. It still averages out above 10. So that's good for B. Cogel. All right, last one. This one comes from the blog from Alan. I'm thinking of trading Justin Upton straight up for Zach Greinke. Thoughts?
It seems crazy just based on where these guys were on draft day and maybe even where they would go in a draft right now, but what is Justin Upton at this point? Slash line very similar to what it was last year when he had the thumb injury. Hasn't been stealing bases really this year as much either. Hasn't even hit that well since April. A lot of that production came in the first month of the season. I mean, if you're really hurting for a starting pitcher, I think you can make this deal. But I get the feeling there's still people in your league who look at Upton and see someone who could be a top 25, top 30 player the rest of the year. And I don't think Greinke's worth that. So I think you can do a little bit better in terms of flipping Upton for a starter at this point.
DVR, I'm going to jump in because Corey's too busy checking his phone to listen to your answer.
I was looking up some valuable data.
I love this trade for the guy getting Greinke. And I'm somebody who thought the Upton of the Braves trade was a great trade for the Braves. But we're now 2.5 of the last 3.5 years. Justin Upton just hasn't really been all that good. He had the big MVP caliber season 2 years ago. 2010, he wasn't that great. 2012, he wasn't that great. We're into 2013 right now. I know that Zach Greinke is going to give me a 3 ERA, a 1 whip, and probably some wins down the stretch. Good strikeout numbers. I make this trade. I actually like your point, DVR, about... there might be something better out there, and I think it's a valid point. Maybe because I'm higher on Greinke than you are, I don't think you're going to do a whole lot better than this.
Yeah, I agree with all that. You know, I think ultimately, I was just having this conversation with a friend of mine who's got Upton and was one of his leagues, just a couple, and I said, you know, maybe the reality is Justin Upton just isn't as good as we thought he is. And, you know, as you said, the evidence is supporting that more and more. You know, compare and contrast this to the last one. Corbin's got the better numbers across the board right now, but I'd rather deal for Greinke because I think I know what he is more than Patrick Corbin. So I'd be more inclined to do this deal than the last one.
I would definitely have Greinke ahead of Corbin as well. The thing I want to ask you guys is, what do you expect Greinke's strikeout rate to actually be? It's been 18.4% so far this year, a little less than 7 per 9 if you prefer that metric. I mean, do you see that actually getting back up closer to his career norms, above 20% at least from this point forward?
Without looking at the schedule and the possible starts it'll get, because over 12 starts, that's going to affect it a lot. I would say probably 20-21%. I think it'll be the rest of the year.
Yeah, he's pitched better the last 3, 4, 5 times out. I think that'll continue to inch up. And typically, and again, I agree with you, I haven't looked at the schedule, but usually in the second half, you have a lot more games in the division. That's against the Padres, against the Giants, some weak offenses there. I think he'll continue to pitch better as we move down the stretch. All right, let's wrap it up. Derek, thank you very much for dialing into the show today, or we dialed you in. Last part is always shameless plugs. Tell our listeners where they can read your stuff and consume your work.
You can check me out at rotowire.com/radio. I got a column that goes up every Friday afternoon, and on SiriusXM, it's XM 87, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Eastern time, Monday through Friday, 4 to 7 Eastern on the weekends. I'm usually on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Saturdays.
Awesome. What's your Twitter handle?
It's at Derek Van Riper.
That's easy to remember. All right, we appreciate it, man. Thanks for joining us today. We'll talk to you soon, buddy.
All right, thanks for having me, guys. Have a great weekend.
All right, you too. All right, that was Derek Van Riper from RotoWire. He does some great work there, so check him out. That'll wrap it up for today's 411. Joe and I will be back on Monday, again, with a two-man booth, just the two of us arguing and having a good time, talking some fantasy baseball. Before we go, give the people your Twitter handle and where they can find all your good stuff.
At Joe_Sheehan, S-H-E-H-A-N, joesheehan.com and joesheehanbaseball.blogspot.com. You get information about the Joe Sheehan Baseball newsletter. And then you can usually find me most weeks in Sports Illustrated, which is not an online entity, but an actual physical magazine.
And, you know, I have to say, I generally try to not be very nice to you when I can avoid it. But a couple of weeks ago, you had the back page in Sports Illustrated, which for those of us growing up, reading Sports Illustrated every week to learn about sports and to consume sports, That's a big trophy. So congratulations on that. Thanks. Brief moment of sincerity. That was really cool to open up to that page. I mean, it's like being on the back page of the Post or the Daily News. It's the first and last thing people see.
There's a lot of history to that space, and I'm very proud to have been. I get to, there's great people there. They gave me that opportunity. I'm very proud.
Congratulations, man. All right, thanks to everybody for tuning in. Thanks to Goose and Spree and the whole crew on the other side of the glass. Thanks to you for listening to the 411. If you're not listening to it on Friday, then we hope you enjoyed your trip through the time machine, because that's what podcasts are. We will see you on Monday. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening to the Fantasy 411.